Honor, too late, realized what she was doing and tried to move out of the way. But he was weakened. From battle, but surely from having tasted of human flesh as well. As he trudged through the sand, he looked as though millstones had been bound to his ankles. Guldrathan focused squarely on Cheda, clubbed Honor with one of his great fists, and Honor, despite his bulk, went flying to fall unmoving against the amber sand. For a moment, Cheda could only stare. She'd meant for it to happen. The joy of seeing Honor fall set her fingers to tingling. But the ease with which Guldrathan had done it, as if the felling of a king was but an afterthought, made her heart go cold. Cheda, Melisse, and Sumeya stood at the ready as the Arek neared. Surprisingly, it slowed and approached with care. Its taurine eyes stared warily at the ebon swords, as if it had faced such a threat before. It began moving its hands in strange ways, outlining symbols in the air. Cheda felt herself slowing. Her body became leaden, and she knew the beast would have all of them in moments if she didn't act. She charged, hoping to distract the beast, to foil its spell, but she had not gone two steps before Guldrathan raised a hand to her. She came to an immediate stop. Something pressed on her from all directions, while a high-pitched tone sounded loud in her ears.
"My wish is not to see thee dead,"
it said in a voice so low it made her skin itch.
"Not yet. I would bring thee to the desert. Study thee before I decide how and when to deliver thy soul to the farther fields. I would follow thy path, O White Wolf. I would reach across the divide to touch the land of my maker's maker once more."
It stretched one arm out, reaching for her neck. But just then a spear streaked through the air from Cheda's right and pierced Guldrathan's skin. Another struck its neck. A third sunk deep into one thigh. Cheda could not move, but she saw a line of desert-garbed warriors hurtling forward. Ishak led them. The ghostly white forms of the Forsaken followed, wailing as they streaked toward the Arek. Leading the way was Salsana, her body now occupied by the soul of an Asea. Behind her came Pharrell and Starven and a half-dozen more. They bore spears and swords and shields. The Forsaken engaged Guldrathan, moving with blinding speed and ferocity while others encircled the beast. As they fought, Cheda felt her limbs slowly loosening. It was the presence of the Forsaken. She could feel the brightness of their souls, pushing away the darkness of the Arek's magic. But it didn't all happen at once. She felt as if she were trapped in honey, so she fought to hasten the process. The more she worked her muscles, she soon found, the looser they became. The need for haste was paramount. Guldrathan was already winning his battle. One of the Forsaken had taken a blow to the head. Pharrell was lost when one of Guldrathan's tails skewered her chest. Blood so dark it was nearly black burst from the wound, and then she was gone, as Guldrathan whipped his tail and sent her flying through the air. A third was crushed beneath one of Guldrathan's cloven hooves. Another was gored and flung away with a vicious lift of his terrible curving horns. Ishak, releasing a long battle cry and wielding a spear, distracted the Arek as Salsana swept in and pierced Guldrathan's right eye with the tip of her own spear. In that moment, Cheda was released. She fell to the ground, but was up again in a blink and rushing toward the Arek. Starven was lost when Guldrathan's great jaws clamped over his right shoulder and tore half his chest away. Another soul dimmed when Guldrathan picked him up and tore his body in two. As it flung the halves of that poor soul's body aside, Ishak rushed in, yelling as he stabbed the spear up beneath Guldrathan's chin. The spearhead was partially lost as it sunk deep into Guldrathan's flesh. Guldrathan staggered back, eyes blinking in confusion at the sky, but the next moment it grabbed the spear and snapped it in two. And then Ishak was driven against the sand by a mighty downward blow.
No!
Chaedah cried. She reached the Erech's side and swung River's Daughter once, twice, backing away quickly when the Erech rounded on her. Each swing of her blade cut deep, some artifact of the Ebon's steel allowing it to bite deeper than mundane weapons seemed to. Melisse and Sumeya fought by her side now. Together they attacked, in constant flow, one retreating while the other two blooded the beast. Black blood flowed from the wounds, slicking the Erech's skin, making it glisten yellow in the mid-morning light. Salsana had lost her knives, but she leapt, trying to claw her way up the Erech's back, only to be thrown off. Another white Aesir took her place, stabbing a knife deep into the Erech's shoulder. Guldrathan reached over its shoulder, grabbed the white-clothed Aesir and flung him against a ship's bowsprit. As he fell, lifeless, to the sand, Guldrathan reared up and bellowed so loudly it brought pain to Chaedah's ears. Then it brought both fists down. Suddenly, the world tilted. Chaedah saw sky, then desert, then sky again. She fell hard and rolled across the sand, her ears ringing. She felt pummeled where the unseen force had struck. Slowly she lifted herself up, only to find those who had been fighting Guldrathan lying like her, 10 paces distant. They were stunned and slowed to rise, even the Forsaken. Guldrathan limped toward Chaedah, its eyes filled with rage, which made her wonder whether it still wanted to take her away and kill her at its leisure, or slay her now for her defiance. Chaedah reached across the sand for River's Daughter. She thought it had fallen next to her. She realized it hadn't. She couldn't see it anywhere. She still had her knife, though. She drew it and tried to stand, but fell to the ground as a wave of dizziness struck. One of the Erech's hooves stepped on her right arm, pinning her hand and the knife. She heard the bones break as white-hot pain burned along her forearm. A scream tore from her throat, which seemed to please Guldrathan. It reached one clawed hand down and said,
"Now."
But got no farther before a buzzing, rattling sound made it lift its head. Chaedah turned in time to see a black cloud sweeping over the desert. It swallowed Guldrathan and lifted the Erech, sending it flying backward. And then the cloud resolved into a tall figure, nearly of a height with Guldrathan. Its silhouette had feminine notes, but retained all the other hallmarks of the Erech. Curving horns, a mane of thorn-like hair, serpentine eyes and taurine legs that ended in cloven hooves. Rumayesh. The last time she had seen her had been in Nalame's temple in Sharakai, moments before she had been trapped in the sapphire. Somehow she had escaped her prison. Or had been released, Chaedah thought, likely by Brahma. She couldn't guess how, but just then she was glad for it. Cradling her right arm, gritting her teeth against the pain, Chaedah took up her knife and watched the battle unfold. The Erech struck one another mightily. They fought like animals, sometimes rolling across the sand. For many long moments they seemed equally matched, but it soon became clear Guldrathan was weakening. It staggered backward, raising its hands to draw more arcane symbols, but Rumayesh saw and charged. Guldrathan dissolved like smoke. In response, Rumayesh crumbled, returning to the cloud of black beetles. The swarm swept up the black smoke, the two twisting as one, flying farther and farther away, surging and swelling until they were lost behind the line of ships. Suddenly the rest of the battle re-entered Chaedor's awareness. All around them, tribesmen fought tribesmen, on the decks of ships, over the sand. Nearby a fight had broken out between Unur's personal guard and Ishak's best warriors. Chaedor sheathed her knife and found River's daughter at last, half hidden in the sand several paces away. She picked it up and then saw Ishak lying face down in the sand, unmoving. She swallowed. There will be time to grieve when the battle is done. And staggered toward the fight, pulling her veil from her face as she went. Stop! She called, pointing to the horizon with her sword. Stop! We cannot fight one another, not if we wish to live! The cries of steel continued to ring. Stop! She cried again. Unur is dead! But the other kings have come, and they're waiting! She pointed River's daughter toward the advancing ships. Look at them! At this, some few paused. With tentative glances, they looked. Beyond the battle, dozens of the king's ships were arrayed like soldiers. Their sails were at the ready, but they were unmoving, which meant they had anchors set, a maneuver used when a ship wished to get on the move quickly. Look at them, she repeated. They wait like jackals. They wait for us to kill each other, that they might take us at our weakest, with little loss to their own numbers. But we need not give them what they want. Chaedor walked down the line of the fighting. Slowly they lowered their guard. Combatants stepped away from each other. Seeing the lull in the battle, more stayed their swords. Men, women, the old, the young, many of them wounded, all held their weapons still, perhaps hoping for an end to the hostilities. The lure of the kings is strong, Chaedor went on, shouting, so that all could hear. I know this more than most. You were drawn to him, Tribe Selmuk. We can all see that. Tribe Masal was as well. Even Tribe Kadri saw in the King of Spears a chance to strike at the heart of Sharakai. You were lured by Onur's false promises, beguiled by the same magic the gods placed upon his shoulders like a mantle. But now, his dark presence has been lifted. We need not fight one another. She lifted River's daughter and described an arc that encompassed the whole of the king's line of ships. Not when our true enemy lies there. Reversing her grip on her ebon sword, she sheathed it with her left hand, then walked toward the warriors from Tribe Selmuk. She held out her good hand in peace to the nearest of them, a woman with a wary expression in her coal-rimmed eyes. We need not fight one another, not while we can grasp hands and free the desert from the yoke of the kings of Sharakai. The woman stared at Chaedor's hand. She looked to the others from her tribe. None gave their assent to take Chaedor's hand, but neither did they deny her. Slowly, the woman reached out. Chaedor! Sumer called, just as Melisse whistled. Enemy! Behind! Chaedor turned just in time to see Onur charging toward her. He held his spear in both hands. Chaedor tried to dodge, but Onur was too quick. He took her in the belly and the spear sank in, sank through her. It pinned her to the sand. A pain as vast as the desert gripped her as Onur's greasy face hung above her, smiling through the cuts, the streaking blood, the lank hair. Chaedor managed to pull her knife from her belt with her good left hand, but the weight of his chest was against her.
At least I'll have you!
He rasped at her, his eyes crazed. He fell across her, nearly exhausted.
At least I'll have you!
Screaming, Chaedor tugged her arm free and the knife with it. With all her might, she drove it against the side of his neck. It plunged all the way to the hilt. Immediately she sawed it free, cutting his throat along with it. Honor blinked, his mouth worked. His blood pulsed against her, a river hot against her chest and neck. And then all his weight fell against her. Chayda's body fell slack. Her toes tingled, but she could no longer feel her hands, nor the broken bones of her right arm. Nor, she realized with a strange sort of curiosity, the spear wound that had traveled all the way through her gut. A weight was lifted from her. Faces staring aghast appeared in a halo around her. She tried to speak to them. Her mouth worked, but nothing came out. They spoke as well, but she heard nothing more than a warbling, a susurrus, an inscrutable tumult of sound that made her wonder if they were uttering farewells, speaking her rights, guiding her to the world beyond. Someone knelt by her side, a woman in a black dress wearing a turban. Her veil was off, revealing a beautiful face, bright brown eyes. She nodded to another dressed like her. Something tugged at her belly. She felt the stabbing pain once more, but only for a moment, as though with that last offering of pain the cost of her passage had been paid in full. The woman with brown eyes held something, a metal flask, no larger than a walnut, which she opened with shaking fingers. Some of the soft blue, strangely bright liquid within spilled, and then the flask was being pressed to her lips. Something cool touched her tongue. Gods, how sweet it tasted! An elixir distilled from the light of the stars themselves. Down her throat it traveled, creating something like warmth within her. As the feeling spread, the pain came once more, and the world around her went dark. Chapter 65. Chayda's eyes fluttered open. Above her, over the roof of a tent that fluttered in the wind, the brightness of the sun shone through, a golden disk on a field of ivory. She blinked and looked away, taking in her surroundings. She lay on thick bedding over a beautifully woven carpet. A dozen tin censers were arrayed around her. One still burned, filling the air with the rich scents of copal and myrrh. More carpets covered the rest of the interior. The center was left clear for a small fire pit. The wind was playful, sending the tents, walls in and out in a rhythm that made Chayda want to sleep again. She fought the urge, trying to lift herself, and grunted at the sudden pain in her gut. Lifting the blanket that covered her, she saw she was wrapped in bandages from her hips all the way to her chest. She let the blanket fall and gripped her right arm, turning it this way and that. Only the smallest twinge of pain accompanied the movements. It had been broken, though. Guldrathan had stepped on it, shattering her bones. She lifted the blanket again. There was some blood on the bandages, but it was dried and old. Gritting her teeth against the pain, she rolled onto her side and pushed herself up. She unwrapped the bandages around her chest and waist to find a faint pink scar running across her stomach. The center was puckered slightly, like a larger version of the wound from the Adhikara's kiss on her right thumb. "You have a big sister," she said as she ran her right hand over the new wound. She was no stranger to wounds, to scars. This could easily have been mistaken for one that was months old. She had little doubt that over the next day it would heal further and grow fainter. The tent flap opened, and Dadzada stepped in. Seeing her standing there naked, his eyes went wide and he turned around.
"Forgive me,"
he said as he stepped back outside. Chayda smiled. As surly as Dadzada always seemed to be, it was funny to see him chastened. She pulled on the dress that lay folded on the carpet, A blue dress made of fine linen with beautiful embroidered panels stitched along the chest, skirt, and voluminous sleeves. She found a mirror on a small wooden chest, winced as she bent to pick it up, and held it high to examine herself. Her face was clean. There were cuts she remembered receiving during the battle that were now as faint as a star at sunrise. Her hair was unbound, clean, and well-combed. There was not a speck of dirt in it, nor was there any trace of blood in her hair or along her scalp. Dardzada's doing. Gods, you've looked better, Chayda. Her eyes were haggard. Her hair was disheveled from having slept on it for, who knew, a day or more? But what matter was that? She was alive. They had apparently survived the battle with the kings. They had lived to fight another day. After setting the mirror back on the chest, she took one of the chairs. Come. Dardzada returned, rubbing his hands over his belly as if he were suddenly worried about his appearance. His left arm was still in a sling. Smiling awkwardly, he took her in, his eyes drifting to her belly.
How does it feel?
I should be dead, she replied. So by any measure that matters, it ought to feel wonderful. In a blink, the old Dardzada returned. He gave her a wooden stare.
How does it feel?
Like I took a good punch, and little more. Dardzada shook his head in amazement, as if he could hardly believe it. I have Emre to thank for this, don't I?
Dardzada nodded.
Apparently he gave the elixir to Sumer when you refused him.
Where is he now? She tried to make it sound as if she didn't truly care, though she felt foolish for doing so. She was a child no longer, and she didn't have to hide her affection from anyone, Dardzada included. Perhaps especially Dardzada.
Just a return from a patrol. They're still concerned that the kings will return. But we suspect they'll be content with the damage they've done to the tribes and the return to Sharakai.
Chayda wondered at it all. By her reckoning, five of the kings were now dead. Azad by her mother's hand, Kulishan, Misut, and Onur by her own. And Usam, though who might have killed him remained a mystery. And yet the task before her still seemed so daunting. Those who lived, Kiral, Isan, Husamatin, Sukru, Kahil, Bashir, and Zaheb, were hardly less powerful than before. They may be fewer in number, Chayda mused, but that only means they've consolidated the power the dead had left behind.
Why would the kings leave? She asked. Even if the four tribes banded together, they could have destroyed us.
True, but there was the Irek, Urumayesh, to contend with. After you fell, Masal and Samuk did join us. When the king saw the end of our battle, they began to close in, but paused when Rumayesh returned.
But they'd risked so much, Chayda said. They'd come so far. They had numbers even with Rumayesh on our side.
Gudrathan lay dead a half league away, and many of the king's ships witnessed that battle. They had lost both King Kiral and Queen Meriam in Emre's bold gambit.
Chayda shook her head, confused.
You'll hear the stories over the fires these coming nights. Suffice to say that Emre, Brahma, and Lord Amansir pulled off a story for the ages. The three of them made their way to Kiral's own ship and destroyed the sapphire that trapped Rumayesh.
Even I will admit it was daring. It likely saved us all.
Dardzada's chest rumbled as he laughed.
Don't tell him I said so.
We wouldn't want Emre thinking you care about him.
I wouldn't want delusions of grandeur making him think he's better than he is.
For the love of the gods, Dardzada, let the man rejoice in doing something good. He shrugged and scratched at his beard, which had quite a bit more salt in it than it used to.
He can rejoice all he wants. Just don't expect me to dance around the fire with him while he does it.
Chayda rolled her eyes. Kiral and Meriem are dead, then?
That's doubtful. I hear they leapt from their ship and were ensorcelled away.
Of course. The heavens forbid a star might shine upon us.
No doubt. But we've done well. Four tribes have agreed to band together. Masit has sent ships carrying emissaries from all four tribes. Ours, Masal, Salmuk, and Kadri, to treat with the others in the desert. Some will resist, no doubt, but some will join us. And others, well, we hope that by showing our strength now, they'll at least not support the kings, lest they make enemies of us.
Chayda wondered at the turn of events. Our future was balanced on a knife's edge.
And will be for some time. But there is hope now. The truth will be revealed. Some will cast doubt on it. Many will refuse to believe that we are anything more than the moonless host, trying to find a place for ourselves in the desert after being run out of Sharakai. Thieves, they'll call us. Barbarians. They'll label us the villains. But others will not.
Dadzada's eyes twinkled, as she had rarely seen them do.
Could it be, Dadzada? Chayda asked him. Are you hopeful?
He considered the question, lips pursed.
I wouldn't put it so. The road ahead is long, but the gods have given us a chance. We have but to take it, and take care. And then, with a bit more luck, perhaps we'll see this through.
Footsteps approached the tent flap.
They're ready!
A voice called. Masid's voice, Chayda realized.
A moment,
Dadzada said, then pushed himself up off his chair and held his hand out to Chayda.
What's happening?
He flicked his fingers at her.
You'll see soon enough.
She took his hand and he helped her to rise. She stepped gingerly over the carpets to the flap where Dadzada held it wide. She saw as she ducked down that there were many gathered outside, but she didn't realize how many until she stood up again. There were hundreds upon hundreds arrayed in a fan before her tent. They stood facing her. Men in thobes and kaftans, women in desert dresses, babes held in mother's arms, children by their sides. They bore the designs of their tribes in the colors they wore, the cut of their clothes, the tattoos on their faces and hands. Tribes Kianat, Kadri, Masal, and Salmuk. All watched Chayda. Masid stood nearby. Behind him were Emre, Melis, and Sumeya. Leora was there with an unabashed smile on her face, though she also looked older than Chayda ever remembered. Shal Alara stood by her side in the role of caretaker. There were dozens of others from the 13th tribe, Hamid, Darius, Frail Lamai, and more.
I don't understand, Chayda said.
Masid stepped forward.
2 nights ago, the kings left the field of battle. Yesterday we tended to our wounded. We built a great pyre for the dead and celebrated all who fought. But you were not there. We had no chance to honor you. We do so now, Chedamin Ayanashala.
With that, he stepped back and knelt. Emre, Hamid, Leora, and everyone nearby did the same. Even Melis and Sumeya, after a pause, nodded to her and knelt on the sand. Then the other tribes did the same, those at the front first, then moving progressively farther back until all of those gathered, the survivors of the deadliest battle the desert had seen since the days of Bet Iman, were on the ground. Their ships curving, in a grand arc behind them. The sight brought tears to her eyes. But it wasn't merely their presence here, nor the fact that they'd somehow managed to survive the kings. This was what her mother had been hoping to achieve. She'd wanted to help carve out an existence for the 13th tribe. Chaedah had played a part, but it had all started with her mother's going to Sharakai, uncovering 3 of the bloody verses and killing King Azad. It felt more than ever as if Aya had passed a candle to Chaedah. It was a beautiful thing to behold. Wiping tears away, she said, "Rise!" But it came out so weakly she was forced to say it again. "Please, rise!" Those nearest did, then more and more until all had risen. Then, as one, they began to shout and hold their hands high, many jumping where they stood or releasing melodic ululations that rose above the deafening sound of the gathered crowd. A celebration was held that night. Arak was passed around the many fires and people danced. 1,000 songs were sung. Chaedah was tired from her long sleep, and she still ached, but she refused to sit for long. She wandered among the many carpets, sitting here for a time, listening to the music played, even joining in, and then she'd move to the next. She heard many tales of woe, but also of bravery, of selflessness. There was anger between the tribes yet, for all that had happened while they had lived beneath Anua's rule, but those wounds were beginning to heal. The threat of the kings had finally bound them together. She came finally to a fire, where Melisse and Sumer were talking with Emre and Maseed. Chaedah sat and listened for a while. She danced with Frail, Lamai, and Maseed, and even Sumer. And then she grew tired and took Emre's hand. Pretty Hadad of Malasan was nearby, and she took note of it. But Chaedah paid her no mind. She took Emre to her tent, and together, amid all the sounds playing out beyond the tent's walls, they held one another. They told their own tales of the battle, sat by a small fire, dined on olives and bread and wine, just like they said they'd do.
"You're smiling too much,"
Emre said to her, as the celebrations outside were beginning to dwindle.
"How can one smile too much?" she asked.
He shook his head, as if he knew he had made a mistake by saying so.
"It's just that there's still so much danger, and..."
"What?"
"Maseed has asked me to go with Ariz, to be our eyes among Tribe Kadri."
Chaedah tilted her head.
"I think you'll be good for him."
Emre poked at the fire.
"I thought you'd be more upset."
She leaned forward, ignoring the pain along her belly, and kissed him.
"I am, but I've reconciled myself to us being apart. There's too much to do, Emre. But one day, when all this is done, we'll do as we said, yes? Sail the great Shangazi together."
He tried to smile.
"I hope we can."
"We will," she said.
And with that she stood and held her hand out to him.
"For now, though, we leave all that behind."
He stared at her hand, suddenly unsure of himself. So she reached down, took the stick he had been using to poke at the fire, and threw it into the flames. She took his hand and pulled him up until the two of them were standing chest to chest. She could feel the warmth coming off him. How good it felt, despite the heat of the tent. She kissed him. The whiskers of his moustache and beard tickled as he placed more kisses along her cheek, her neck. Their hands roamed, and soon they moved to her blankets, where the two of them did leave everything behind. The sounds of the celebration played around them, mixing with the heady effects of the arak she had drunk. Emre removed her clothes, taking great care for her wounds. She removed his, taking much less care. And then she reveled in his shape, noting just how many more scars he had than when they were young. They made love, simply, sweetly. The music and voices felt otherworldly, the perfect counterpoint to how real Emre felt in her arms. And when they were done, they lay side by side, Emre's head cradled along her shoulder as she ran her fingernails up and down his back. Like that, they fell asleep. Chade awoke some time later with a dread inside her, feeling watched. All had gone dark outside the tent. The fire within was little more than embers. She looked around the tent and shook when she realized a silent figure was sitting beside the fire. As she sat up, pulling the blanket up to cover her nakedness, the figure reached down and stoked the fire back to life with a triple-bladed knife. A bloody light was shed across the tent's interior, especially on King Isan himself. He blew upon the blades of the knife, clearing them of ash, and set it across his knees. Chade realized both her sword belt and Emre's, which had been lying near the bed earlier, had been moved to the far side of the tent. When she nudged Emre, he didn't stir, and his breathing retained the even rhythm of a man in the depths of slumber.
"I think it would be best if it's only the two of us," Isan said. "Wouldn't you agree?"
"What are you doing here?"
Isan feigned surprise.
"Why, I've come to see the fruits of your labor."
A smile lit his fine features as he gave a wave that encompassed the entire camp outside the tent's walls.
"It's quite a tale. 4 tribes to call to your banner, with more likely on their way, especially if I whisper in their ears. And meanwhile, the king's vaunted navy returns to Sharakai, thwarted."
"If you're not careful, my lord king, you'll have nothing left to rule."
"That's truer than you know," he said with a wink.
"What do you mean?"
"Forgive me, but were you under the impression the king's left because they feared you?"
"Then why did they leave?"
"It may not surprise you to learn that the young king of Malasan and the queen of Mireya both covered the amber jewel of the desert. In a new development, fleets flying their colors now sail the desert. They're making for Sharakai as we speak." He paused. "We've entered a new phase in the struggle, Chedamin. The 4 kingdoms were always going to play a part in this war, and now it has begun. Mireya, Kaimir, and Malasan have all shown their hands. The 1,000 territories have yet to make a stand, but I'm certain they'll play their part."
"War comes to Sharakai,"
Chada said breathlessly, feeling as though her world were no longer expanding but shrinking.
"To its very doorstep. We have to tread carefully now, kings and tribes both, lest we lose it all."
Chada's eyes snapped back to Isan's.
"We?
Do we not still have common ground?
You tried to have me killed in Sukru's palace."
"I can assure you that was not me,"
Isan frowned.
"I can only think Davood was promised some reward should he manage to kill you. He's gone missing, did you know?"
She shook her head.
"He's not been seen since he left through that strange device. We're all most curious where he's gone. Whoever is hiding him, they have the answers to your riddle."
"You call it a riddle?"
"I name it so because it is one. Why in the great white desert would I wish you dead? You're the answer to my prayers. Until I prove an obstacle to your plans." "Granted, but I think we can agree that you are not that yet."
He paused, one hand waving to where she and Emre lay.
Come, if I'd wished you dead, I would have done it by now.
There was no denying that. She softened her tone.
I'm weary, Izan.
Then I shan't occupy you much longer. There are but two points of business that remain. The first. Have you seen the goddess Nalame since the Night of Endless Swords?
Now that was an unexpected question.
No. Why do you ask?
Because I fear she is in danger.
A sudden spike of fear ran through her.
Yorinde?
Izan peered more closely at her, his face lit a ghastly crimson from the fire.
You said you hadn't seen her.
I haven't.
She told him what Leora had done with the worm, how Nalame had come to even the scales, as she had put it.
Onur found the gem among the treasures of Tribe Masal, but it was Yorinde who granted him the power over the worm.
Well, well, well.
Isan's eyes searched the embers of the fire.
The sands hide many secrets, do they not? Let me ask you, would you find it strange to learn that Yorinde herself asked the kings for Nalame's head?
He didn't wait for a reply.
I did. I also find it strange that the gods have seen fit to watch this conflict from afar. They granted gifts that secured the kings our power over Sharakai and the desert. Now it crumbles before our very eyes, and the gods have not lifted a finger to shore up that which they helped build. Moreover, they seem ready to employ us as servants, to destroy the goddess they've hounded and killed many times before.
Why?
Indeed.
It was a puzzle Chayda had been trying to unlock since learning the truth about Bet Iman.
They know something we don't.
If you're right, and I've no doubt you are, it would be in our best interests to discover what it is. And so I ask you again, Chedamin, have you seen Nalame?
Even if I had, I wouldn't tell you. She is the 13th tribe's greatest ally against you and the other kings. And now, apparently, the other gods of the desert as well.
So what was your second point? Isan picked up his knife.
You may level many charges against me, but I do not wish the goddess dead. Your assessment of the other gods, however, may prove all too accurate.
He examined the edges of his knife.
Promise me you'll think on it.
Chayda merely stared.
I'll take that as agreement.
He stood, and with an easy move, sheathed the knife.
Very well. The second. We made a bargain on the Mount of Sharakai.
Chayda's heart tripped, then began racing. She hadn't forgotten the bargain, but she hadn't dreamed that Isan would follow through on it.
Return to me, he told her Antoriat, and I'll grant you something I know you want.
What could you grant me? She had asked.
Why, the name of your father.
She sat there unwilling to move, almost unwilling to speak, lest Isan changed his mind.
Who is he?
She finally asked. He made his way to the tent flap, pulled it aside, and stepped halfway through.
Your sire, he said, looking back, caught your mother after she took her knife to Azad's throat. He was the very one who sought to stop you in the blooming fields, the one who granted you your blade.
He stepped out, and the tent flap closed behind him.
Your father, Husamatin, the King of Swords.
His footsteps shushed against the sand, slowly fading, and Chayda's heart began to beat again.
Chapter 66. From the deck of the Blue Heron,
Ramad pointed to a spot of clear sand just short of the 8 ponderous wrecks ahead.
Anchor there.
Aye,
Vrago replied, and guided the ship in while Tiron and Chichio began pulling in the sails. As the ship slid to a halt, Ramad dropped the heavy anchor over the prow. It fell against the sand with a resounding thud. Shovels in hand, the four of them leapt over the gunwales. The nearest of the wrecks was a caravel that had already been denuded of everything useful. Sails, rope, weapons, equipment. The ship itself had a rotted hull, half-eaten decks, and a collection of blackened masts. The work of the great worm's acid. It had rightly been left behind as useless. As deeply as the acid had eaten into the beams below, it would have been dangerous to sail. Two other sand ships had been abandoned for similar reasons. Another four had been burned by firepots. All seven had been stripped of anything of value. Ramad vaguely wondered where the worm was now. It had appeared mortally wounded after the attack by the Forsaken. It had fled, its wings no longer able to bear it aloft, slithering over the ground like a desert asp. No one had wanted to chase it. Ahead lay the 8th ship, a schooner that had been treated in an entirely different manner from the other ships. The deck and starboard hull amidships was little more than a shambles of shattered bulwarks, torn up planks and broken beams, exposing much of the ship's interior. It might still have been repaired, but the tribes had been too fearful to go near it, for this was not the work of the dragon, but of Guldrathan, the fearsome Erek.
That thing puts a chill in my bones, Chichio said.
Ramad agreed. It looked like a ghost ship. The canvas and rigging were intact. The full complement of ballistae and bolts and catapults and firepots were all still there. A good bit of sand had built up over its deck and skis, but otherwise looked little different than it had a week ago, after the battle had ended. Between the abandoned ships was the spot where Chaedah had fought both Onor and Guldrathan, where the Forsaken had swarmed to protect her. It was where Ishak, Kirhanava, of the Moonless Host and the 13th Tribe had died. It was also the place where Hamza Kir had been run down and slain by Guldrathan.
Here,
Ramad said, pointing to an unremarkable patch of sand, and the four of them set to, shovels biting in a rhythmic pattern. Nearly 300 had died in the fierce battle. Ishak, the foremost among them, had been given back to the desert. Wrapped in white linen with the weapons of his enemies placed in a skiff and set adrift for the desert winds to take him where they would. Other skiffs held several warriors to each skiff, some up to a dozen. Too many had died, however, to perform the ritual for all of them. Most bodies had simply been burned in a great pyre, their remains buried in the sand. There had been two notable exceptions. Onor, the feasting king, and the blood mage, Hamza Kir. The tribes would not risk angering Baki by leaving them to rot beneath the sun, but neither had been given shrouds, nor had a single word been uttered over their graves. They had simply been dumped into a hole and covered, to be forgotten by man and god alike. Ramad was not normally in the business of disturbing graves, but there was a mystery that needed solving. Before the battle, Brahma had told Ramad what he had seen in the cabin of Kiral's ship. Kiral had been there, as had Meriam and Amaryllis, but so had Hamza Kir. Something odd had occurred just before Brahma had arrived.
They'd been pulling on their clothes, Brahma had said.
Why? Ramad had asked.
Brahma hadn't been sure, but Ramad had an inkling. He had kept his thoughts to himself, however. It was the sort of information that, if true, an outsider like Brahma should never have. They dug for a long while, missing the mark several times before Chichio called,
"Here!"
They dug around the bodies and slowly but surely uncovered the tall figure of Hamzakir and half of the ox-like frame of Anur. Ramad knelt by Hamzakir's side. He could detect no difference between his memories of the man and the dusty, sunken corpse he found lying before him. But that meant little. Meriem's magic had always been impressive. Taking a deep breath, Ramad placed his hands on Hamzakir's face. He'd never tried to unwork a spell once it had been wrought, but he tried now. He ran his hands over Hamzakir's features, cheeks, nose, mouth, even his hair, and tried to guide the magic away, as he'd done with Hamzakir in the temple, and again with Meriem as she stood on the deck of the galleon. After long moments, nothing changed, nor could Ramad sense the fabric of woven magic. Over and over again he tried, to no avail. Hamzakir looked the same as he ever had. Pulling out his knife, he cut Hamzakir's robes down the front to expose his chest. The corpse's skin was pasty white with various blemishes and a pattern of hair across chest and stomach that reminded Ramad of a sword hilt. He tried there as well, wondering if working closer to his heart would have more effect. But here, too, he failed to find any trace of magic.
"Is it Hamzakir, then?"
Tiron asked after a time. Ramad realized how long he had been staring. The men were nervous. They wanted to leave.
"I don't know," he said. "Give me more time. Could I have been wrong about Meriem? About all of this?"
He refused to believe it. Like stones across a stream, he could trace a series of events all the way from the abduction of Hamzakir near Kulishan's desert palace to Meriem's order to have Ramad killed. The most important of them was the battle for Hamzakir's mind in Via Rosa. But then came Alduin's death in the desert at the hands of the Arek Guldrathan, and later, after they'd reached Sharakai, Meriem's refusal to return home to Chimir, even when her duties as queen became ever more urgent. The trail ended with her insistence on dealing directly with Kiral to rid the desert of Hamzakir, the price of which was nothing less than Malasan itself, and a chance to rule those lands once their armies had been crushed in the looming war. Over the months, Meriem had become more harried. She had become ever more eager to distance herself from Ramad. But then came the event that had opened Ramad's eyes for good. The sapphire. After stealing it from Brahma, they had performed the ritual to bind it anew. They had cut away the leather cords and cleaned it. Meriem had applied a mixture of goat fat and smoke from her own burning blood so that Rumayesh would be chained to her will. At the closing of that ritual, the Arek had nearly caught Ramad in her spell. Meriem had clipped her locket closed to prevent it, but in that moment, Rumayesh had summoned up a memory. Meriem sobbing in the desert oasis after they'd escaped Guldrathan.
"I've done a terrible thing, Ramad."
Meriem's father had just died. She'd been despondent, nearly inconsolable. Rumayesh had clearly done it in hopes of causing discord between them, enough that she might free herself or ensorcel one of them to do it for her. But Ramad hadn't understood. How would that particular memory help Rumayesh? During the battle after Brahma had shattered the sapphire and freed Rumayesh, Ramad had been petrified, even more than while standing before Guldrathan. Even so, he had had every intention of asking the Arek about Meriem. He needed proof. His chance never came, however. The last he had seen of Rumayesh and Guldrathan was when they had flown from the battle in an undulating cloud of smoke and black beetles. Brahma had followed them numbly. Neither he nor Rumayesh had been seen since. Ramad had tried to convince himself that the memory was nothing more than a desperate attempt by Rumayesh to save herself. A lie, in essence. But there was the rub. For the implications of that memory to create any sort of rift between Ramad and Meriem, it had to be true.
I've done a terrible thing.
Had Meriem planned all along to break Khamzakir's mind and pretend she had been ensorcelled by him, might that give her the perfect excuse to remove her father from the throne? If so, it would be a simple thing to draw Ramad into her plans in Via Rosa, and to force him to play his part in covering up her crimes. He recalled how eager she had been at the thought of breaking Khamzakir. She'd already broken him, Ramad understood now. She must have. The rest had been for Ramad's benefit. So he had believed that Khamzakir had in fact dominated them both. The only part Ramad didn't understand was her father's death. If she meant to kill him, why not do it in the capital? Why take them to Guldrathan? Perhaps it was unforeseen, a miscalculation on Meriem's part. Or for her plans to work, did Khamzakir need some free will? And he had chosen the method of Alduin's death. Or maybe she had foreseen it all, and hoped to trick Guldrathan into killing Kiral, disguised as Khamzakir. Whatever the case after Alduin's death, Khamzakir had begun laying the groundwork of her plans in Sharakai. He had made overtures to Kiral to give up the identity of the Moonless Host's leaders. Kiral had taken the bait, for it served his purposes, but it served Meriem's as well. She had weakened the Moonless Host, even as she made her bargain with Kiral to ensure her eventual place in the House of Kings.
That was her goal all along. The throne of Sharakai.
Hadn't she said as much? How better to take it than as a woman who controlled Kiral himself, or the man who looked like him? As Ramad stared at Khamzakir's face once more, a cold dread inside him began to expand. He had been certain Khamzakir and Kiral had switched forms, but he could sense none of Meriem's magic. Was he wrong? Was this, in fact, Khamzakir?
My lord, Tiron said as he glanced to the dead ships. Perhaps we should bury them.
Yes, Ramad stood and picked up his shovel. Very well.
They began covering the two men once more, sand piled higher and higher, covering legs, arms, chests. When Vrago tossed some onto Khamzakir's face, however, Ramad started.
Stop!
He called, raising one hand. In a rush, he dropped to Khamzakir's side and brushed away the sand from the left side of his face. There, along his jaw, was a lone pockmark. Ramad ran a finger over it. Peering close, he saw the barest signs that there were more, but they were extremely shallow. He pressed one hand against Kiral's cheek, closed his eyes and used his power to feel for that lone mark on Khamzakir's face. Rumayesh had done this, he realized, not Meriem, which was why he had been unable to sense it. It was more subtle than Meriem's magic, but now he had found the way to unravel it. Like a knife through a chink in armor, he pressed and found his way through. Slowly the whole of the spell was revealed, and he rubbed his hands over Khamzakir's face once more. He ran his fingers through his wiry hair and beard. With each movement, the face before him changed just a little bit more. The beard sloughed from his chin and cheeks. The hair atop his head did as well,
leaving it closely shorn. Bones popped and cracked as his face widened, transforming from Khamzakiya's narrow face to one with broad cheeks and a strong jaw. The pockmark